Welcome to the TWIML AI Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. Hey, what's up, everyone? Before we dive into today's show, I want to give you a heads up on a bunch of upcoming programs we'll be bringing you in August. There is sure to be something here for everyone. And if there's not, feel free to reach out to me on our Slack to let me know what you'd like to see. This is your last chance to sign up for Saturday's webinar on Amazon SageMaker with Luigi Petruno. Luigi and I will be digging into what SageMaker is and why you should care about it, and how learning SageMaker or a tool like it can help data scientists be both more effective in their current roles and better positioned for their next job. To learn more, visit twimlai.com/SageMaker. Then on Monday, August 3rd, we'll be bringing you another TWIML watch party, this time with Yordanis Karanidis of CNRS Paris and QC Ware. This will be a great conversation about challenges and recent advances in quantum machine learning that I think you'll really enjoy. As usual, Yordanis and I will be in the chat answering all of your questions. For info on this one, visit twimlai.com/watch397. Finally, on Tuesday, August 11th, we'll be convening the latest event in our discussion series, this time digging into the important topic of model explainability with experts from Cornell, Carnegie Mellon, Harvard, IBM, and more. As always, your questions play a big role in this discussion, which is sure to be amazing, so don't miss it. Visit twimlai.com/explainabilityforum for more information and to register. We're almost there. Before we dive in, I'd like to send a huge thank you once again to our friends at Qualcomm for their support of the podcast and their sponsorship of this ICML series. Qualcomm AI Research is dedicated to advancing AI to make its core capabilities, perception, reasoning, and action, ubiquitous across devices. Their work makes it possible for billions of users around the world to have AI-enhanced experiences on Qualcomm Technologies-powered devices. To learn more about what Qualcomm is up to on the research front, visit twimlai.com/qualcomm1. And now, on to the show. All right, everyone, I am here with Elaine Nsoisi. Elaine is an assistant professor of global health at Boston University. Elaine, welcome to the TWIML AI podcast.
Thank you for having me, Sam.
Absolutely. Really looking forward to digging into the conversation. You are working on a lot of interesting topics centered around an area that we're all paying a lot of attention to, epidemiology. Who knew that you would be, you know, in a role that everyone's curious about when you started this? How did you get started?
Yeah, so I'm originally from Cameroon, moved to the US at 16, and I studied math as an undergrad, but I really wanted to do applied math. I wasn't really good at theoretical math. And so I applied to programs, was thinking about doing biostats, because I was interested in health applications of math. And then my mentor, I did an internship at NIH, and my mentor said, so that's the National Institutes of Health in DC. And my mentor said, study statistics instead of biostats. And she said, you would learn the methods and you can apply them to whatever you want to apply it to instead of just focusing on the specific area of statistics. So I applied really late into a statistics program at Virginia Tech, got accepted. And I did my master's in statistics, but I still wanted to do more applied stuff. And I was already working in a lab that I was doing computational epidemiology. So they were developing these large-scale models to predict how diseases were spread. So they would take a city like Seattle, for example, and replicate the population of Seattle down to the census level. So if you took a census of the city of Seattle and you took a census of the model, it would be identical. And then they would simulate disease spread over those populations and see how it spread, and then look at different interventions. So basically what we're doing right now in real life, so they would say, if we close schools, what would happen? if we shut down businesses, what would happen? If we had a vaccine that was like 80% effective, what would happen to the population? So I got really fascinated by that and decided I wanted to do my PhD in that area. So I ended up getting a PhD in computational epidemiology.
Oh, wow. And what was your specific PhD topic?
Forecasting influenza spread using network models.
Using network models?
Yeah.
And have you applied the similar types of techniques to COVID data?
Did they apply
equally, or is there something specific to influenza?
I haven't, but I have colleagues who are doing that. We're using some of those models that we developed back in the day to do those predictions.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. So you have fairly broad research interests, and you presented on quite a few of those at the recent Machine Learning for Global Health workshop at ICML. Your presentation focused on kind of the intersection of machine learning and epidemiology. Before we dig into your specific research interests, I'm curious can you give us some background on that workshop and the theme that brought folks together?
Yeah, so the workshop was focused on global health, and it brought together a very diverse group of people to talk about different problems in global health and how they were trying to solve those problems. So the main focus was, well, how are people using machine learning in different spaces, and what are the specific problems that they were trying to address?
Mm-hmm. And in terms of your specific research, let's talk through some of the things that you're focused on it. But actually, before we get to specific projects, how do you describe your research interest broadly?
I am very interested in data and technology. So if I see a data set, I want to know how can we use this data to improve health. So I think about things that people have not done before and what are novel ways to look at things. So for example, in 2014, I started thinking about restaurant reviews. So if people were going to restaurants and eating and writing reviews about those restaurants, that could be a useful form of information. So if we wanted to track the spread of foodborne diseases in the community, we could use that data. And you had departments of health that were actually thinking about that same problem at about the same time. And so we developed all these models where we would mine information from places like Yelp. So if someone went to Yelp, ate at a restaurant, and wrote about their experience on Yelp, we captured that data and looked at what people were talking about and how that could inform disease surveillance. So that's what I'm really interested in. So if there's a digital data source out there, I want to know how can we use it to improve health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember you speaking about this, the restaurant review at Black and AI. Was that this year or the most recent year or the year before?
That was last year, yeah.
Okay. And give us a little bit more on that use case and what some of the things that came out of it were.
Yeah, so we actually worked with local departments of health to develop a platform where they could look at reviews as they come in and look at postings on Twitter. So if people were posting about having foodborne illness in a particular city, they could see what people were saying. And then there are two things they could do. If a lot of people were talking about the same restaurant, they could actually go out and do targeted restaurant inspections. So instead of just having things scheduled in the future, they can say, it looks like something is wrong right now, let's go check it. Where the idea was that if there's something wrong with the restaurant, then it can stop more people from getting infected. And then the second thing was, if people were talking about having similar symptoms about the same time, then they could actually go out and do outbreak investigations. So there could be an outbreak happening in the community. If you have 10 people talking about having similar symptoms within the same day or 2 days, or even within the same week, so they could actually go out and investigate if outbreaks have happened. And there are health departments that have been able to find outbreaks that were not reported to them by looking at what people were posting on those websites.
If I remember correctly, one of the things that caught my eye or ear at the time was that you were doing some work with, I think you mentioned St. Louis in, which, you know, where I'm based. You were working with the local health department here?
Correct. Yes. So we worked with them to develop a platform to survey, to monitor reports of foodborne illnesses.
Okay. Yeah. Very cool. Yeah, I think one of the things that, you know, outside of, you know, the occasional movie like Outbreak and the like, you know, that has become a lot more clear about epidemiology to many of us is how much work goes into actually surveilling and tracking and all of these, you know, all these things that these agencies are doing behind the scenes to kind of monitor, you know, diseases. I don't think I had a full appreciation for that before COVID.
Yes. And when public health is working, we don't really think about it. Mm-hmm. It's when we have major outbreaks and we see things happening in our communities that we start thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the use cases that you explored in your presentation. One of the ones that I know you're really excited about is some work you did around satellite imagery. What was the problem there that you were looking to solve?
So the idea for that project was to think about ways in which we get data. If we had an outbreak, let's say we had like the current pandemic, and it started in a location where we didn't have access to data, is there a way that we can look at what is happening in the community to get signals that there's actually something happening? Or you can even think about it retrospectively. So let's say there's been an outbreak that started somewhere and we don't know when it started. We don't know when people started getting infected. Can we go back and look at satellite images of hospital parking lots to see if there was a significant change at a particular point that could lead us to investigate a bit more whether that was when the outbreak started? So for this particular study, we looked at three different countries. I think it was Mexico, Chile, and Argentina. And we looked at hospitals in those countries, and we looked at hospital parking lots and tracked how people were using parking lots over time to see how that compared with reports of influenza-like illnesses in those communities. And we were able to show that you could actually capture trends in influenza-like illnesses during the flu season by just looking at how people were using hospital parking lots.
Oh, wow. And so the data sources were these open source data sets that were readily accessible online, or did you acquire them directly from the satellite companies? Where did the data sets come from?
So we had to buy the data. We worked with a company to buy the data from Digital Globe.
Okay.
To see if, yeah. So we had to target specific hospitals, so the company helped us to identify and collect or retrospectively find that data for those hospitals.
Okay. And was the data expensive, or is it pretty easy for you to get that data?
It was expensive, but we've also done studies where we've used Google data, satellite imagery data to look at things like inequalities in US cities. So one idea was that if we can capture the built environment in a particular neighborhood, we could see whether that could link to specific health outcomes. So if you go to some states and you move between one neighborhood to the next, the life expectancy can be as much, the difference can be as much as 16 to 20 years. And the reason for that is things like low income versus high income, which leads to access to different resources. It leads to issues around safety. And so looking at the neighborhood, we constructed an indicator for different neighborhoods across six different cities. And so a neighborhood in that case is a census tract, and on average it has about 3,000 people. And we constructed an indicator and then showed that by just looking at the neighborhood, you could tell which neighborhoods are going to have higher obesity prevalence and which ones are going to have low obesity prevalence.
Yeah, going back to the satellite imagery and the parking lot. So you've got this input data coming from Digital Globe that's unlabeled. Did you compare that to reported just reported incidents of, was it flu?
The influenza? Yeah, influenza like illnesses. So it wasn't just the flu. We also had the common cold and other viruses that have similar symptoms when people get infected.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you essentially produce a labeled set based on this publicly reported information.
Correct. So for each satellite image of a hospital, we would have, the company would basically count the number of cars that were in that image. So mm-hmm. they would draw a line across the neighborhood of that hospital and then count how many cars were in the parking lots. And mm-hmm. how many parking lot spaces were available. So if you had an overfill, then that would signify that a lot of people were showing up. And we could look at this data over time to see how it had changed and how that could possibly relate to disease outbreaks.
Mm-hmm. And was the, you know, when you think of that use case, was the primary, you know, novelty or contribution, just the application of satellite imagery to this aspect of public health, or did you have to do some interesting tricks with either the satellite data or with the labels or, you know, the network that you were using?
I think it was mostly the novel application to this mm-hmm. particular problem. We know that we can use things like social media data and other data sources, but those are not always available in some countries. And so we were trying to think about what is something that is available for every country, at least hopefully available if you can afford mm-hmm. it, and could that be useful for disease surveillance?
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. And so did you find any, were there interesting, what surprised you in doing that? Was it all kind of straightforward, what you expected it to work and it worked and, you know, great? Or did you run into a lot of surprising results?
I really wasn't expecting it to work. Because, I mean, there's so much that happens in a hospital. So people could be showing up at the hospital for so many different reasons. And we try to control for those reasons and look at what are some other reasons why people would be at the hospital. Mm-hmm. But none of them could actually predict as well as when we looked at disease cases for that particular period. So it was definitely surprising to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so that was one of the examples that you talked about at this presentation. You also spent some time talking about health behaviors in Africa in particular. You know, tell us about your research there.
So the studies that we're doing in Africa are around trying to think about how people are changing their behaviors as cities grow, as people have access to things that maybe were not there before. A good example is fast food restaurants. So in the last 2 years, I've traveled across several African countries for conferences and meetings, and they're just places that did not have fast food restaurants now have them. So you go, you see KFC, and you see all these different fast food restaurants that are based in the US. And that is changing the way people eat, is changing the way people think about food, but it's also changing, it's all affecting people's health as well. So places where we didn't used to have high prevalences of chronic diseases are now starting to have that. And the expectation is that over time, it's just going to continue increasing. And so we've been thinking, how can we start setting up a framework where we can use some of the information that people are putting on the internet to monitor changes in behaviors and hopefully predict how those diseases will, the prevalence of diseases will change over time.
And so what are some of the specific types of information that you're looking at there?
So we've been looking at search data specifically. So are people searching for things like, how do I lose weight? Or are people searching for specific diets? Are people looking for gyms? Are people looking for other things that could indicate that either their diets have changed or that they're trying to get healthy? And then try to see how that links to or correlates with obesity prevalence across different regions.
And what kind of results did you find there?
It's been very interesting. So the things that are so obvious, the things that we're actually finding, so things like how to lose weight tend to be very significant when you look at its correlation with obesity prevalence, or people searching for gyms or treadmills, for example, those all correlate with obesity prevalence. And so it's something that I hope to find, but it's also, how do we use this information now that we know that people are searching for those things across the continent? How can we use it to build interventions to prevent the increase of this chronic diseases?
This is the one that surprises me a little bit. I would think that some cities are just more health conscious or fit or something like that, and the people in those cities look for gyms more than others, independent of whether they're, you know, particularly, I guess, health consciousness, you know, there's going to be a correlation to health consciousness, but not necessarily to obesity. You know, they may be less obese because they search for this more, because just based on the culture of that city. Did you run into issues like that?
No. So we've not done this down at the city level. Most of the data we have right now is at the country level. So we're looking at all of this at the country level.
Okay.
But that could be one factor. But as cities grow as well and become more health conscious, you also see an increase in obesity as well, because there are going to be people who are working out, and there are going to be people who don't have access to the resources to actually work out or to eat healthy.
Got it. And so what types of specific approaches did you apply to the data to get to the results that you got?
So most of the data is pretty straightforward to download. You go to Google Trends and you can get search trends for different terms. And then we do modeling. So we use things like random forest regression to see if we can actually, because we have 111 terms that we used, and then try to figure out which ones are most predictive and which ones would be useful in actually in using the model to look at obesity prevalence.
Mm-hmm. And the looking for gyms and those kinds of terms were the ones that you found to be most predictive?
Yeah, those are the ones that we're finding to be most predictive.
Were there ones that surprised you that you thought would be more predictive than they actually were?
Not really. It was maybe too typical, I guess, in a sense, because we've done similar studies for the US where we looked at obesity and other things. And these are the things that we ended up seeing. So it's kind of being reflected in African countries. But I'm sure if we start looking at, you know, regions or cities, we'll see variability in what people are looking for.
Got it. So going back to kind of what was most interesting here, in this case, it was the application of this information, where you applied it, as opposed to the specific, you know, techniques that you use or data, because you've done or have seen similar things done here.
Yeah, precisely. It's where it's being applied.
Okay. What's your take on the general state of applying these kinds of approaches to understanding health in Africa in general?
I think I'm excited. I'm excited that, you know, there is data, because for years I was looking for this kind of data to see if it could be useful. So I'm excited that there is data. But I think there's still a need to develop more contextualized approaches, especially when we start thinking about interventions, because the way people approach things in most African countries is not going to be the same as in the US or in the Western world. And so there's still that need of, okay, now we know people are searching for this, but if we had to develop interventions, how would we develop those interventions, and how would we make sure that they're effective?
So meaning the approaches that we might use from a analytical perspective to identify, you know, the key terms are the same, but then when we want to actually do something about it, the approaches, you know, are likely to be very different.
Yes. Actually, in both cases, it could be different.
Okay.
So approaches to identifying key terms might also be different. And we've seen that in a different study. I think it just depends on the topic.
We just got lucky on the health behaviors one.
Yeah, so health behaviors one seems to work. But if we looked at infectious diseases and we found that we actually had to think very differently in terms of what people would be looking for.
In what way?
In the fact that, so we looked at influenza-like illnesses. So we wanted to see if someone had the flu, would they actually go and search for the kinds of symptoms that people in the US search for? And that was not the case. So people would not search for a Tamiflu flu or search for, I don't know, what else do people tend to search for in the US? So they might not search for the specific symptoms that people look for in the US, but they would search for home remedies instead. So they might look up whether ginger actually works or if a specific type of tea works. And so we had people who were from Cameroon tell us, like, and also from Nigeria as well, tell us, like, what would your mother search for? She was on Google looking up things and she had the cold.
Okay.
So what are some of those terms? And we found those to be very useful.
Like, does chicken soup work for the cold or something?
Yeah.
As opposed to treatment for achy muscles or something.
Precisely. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Interesting. So we've talked a little bit around COVID and everything that's happening here and around the world with regard to COVID. Have you done, well, what specifically have you done around COVID?
We've done a lot around.
And even taking a step back from that, what is it like being an epidemiologist now, you know, with epidemiologists at center stage during a global pandemic? Does it feel like you're at center stage? Like
it does. It does. Okay. I mean, interviews, I've done a lot more interviews this year than I probably did in the last 3 years. And it's sometimes exciting, sometimes it's not, because you end up answering the same questions over and over again. And people have had very different experiences. There are people who've published papers and they got a lot of negative feedback from the public or attacks. I even have friends who have been attacked by opposition parties in the countries where they're working. Mm-hmm. And so it's not always fun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What are the questions that you don't get asked over and over again in these interviews around COVID epidemiology that you think you should be asked more of because they're, you know, interesting and people aren't thinking about them?
I think there's been a lot more conversation around race and ethnicity in the last 2 months than there was at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad that it's happening, because I think it's very, very important that we should have those conversations and how different groups of people are being affected by this and what we can do to make sure that those populations have the resources they need and that they're receiving the treatments that they need.
And is that an area that you've researched?
That is an area that I have collaborated with researchers to look at. So we did one study where we looked at low income versus high income individuals and how there was social distancing during lockdowns across the US. And what we found was that people from lower income neighborhoods their social distancing was less compared to higher income groups. And that could be because a lot of people have essential jobs. And so they're constantly out and being in contact with people and being exposed to the virus. So they're more likely to get infected and bring that back to their households and get others infected as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I think you hear a lot about, at least if you're, you know, paying attention to the disparity in the way COVID has impacted different communities, that there are in a lot of communities, Black communities, Latino communities, this kind of essential worker status. People need to go work, you know, in public transportation systems and grocery stores and things like this. And so that is going to drive a lot of the exposure. Did you were there any changes in the, or any differences in the way, you know, aside from kind of work-related responsibilities, people responded to the disease from a social distance perspective?
So the data that we looked at was mobility data. So we can always see where people were at different times and when lockdowns were happening and when they were not happening. So we didn't really have information on like individual groups and what other experiences they were going through at the time.
Got it.
But there are two major issues, I think. One being that a lot of those groups are doing essential works and so they're being exposed. But then they are also the ones that have a lot of the pre-existing conditions that tend to lead to severe COVID disease. And we know that one of the reasons why things exist the way they do is because of structural inequalities to what do people have access to, what resources do they have, and how can they be healthy when they don't have the same access to the kinds of resources that higher income groups have.
Mm-hmm. So what's an example of that?
Grocery stores, for example. If you go to different neighborhoods, if you go to poorer neighborhoods, you look at the grocery store options, you don't always have access to healthy foods. So the foods that are on the shelves are not always the kinds of foods that you will see in higher income neighborhoods. Cost is also an issue. So you can have access to a place, but you can't afford the food because you don't have the money to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. And so that, as an example, as an effect that impacts long-term health and chronic disease and
precisely
all these things.
Yeah.
Okay. It seems like a lot of studies on social distancing or a lot of work has been done around these mobility data sets from, you know, cell phone data and others. You also looked at the role of, you know, when you talk about kind of the role of income in the disease, is it primarily around attaching this mobility data to, you know, where folks lived, or are there other ways that you've looked at that question?
Yeah, it's mostly around where folks live versus where they work. So if you look at someone's timeline, are they spending more time at where you would consider, let's say, a grocery store, or are they spending more time at your home?
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. What are some of the other examples that you gave at your talk, or, you know, around this intersection of machine learning and epidemiology?
Yeah, so one of the other ones that I mentioned before was still back to satellite images, but looking more at the environment and how that links to health. So that was one other example that I gave, where we were looking at disparities across neighborhoods in six different cities and thinking about, if you looked at a neighborhood, can you use that as an indicator to predict the health outcomes of individuals in that neighborhood? And that gets you thinking about access and how can we change the way neighborhoods are designed so that people have access to the resources that they need to be healthy.
So if you're starting from a satellite image and you're using that to try to predict what specifically?
Access to
obesity prevalence?
Yeah.
Okay. I can imagine like so many different ways that you might go about, you know, trying to do that. What did you find worked?
You mean in terms of methods or how?
Yeah, well, I guess both. You know, what methods drove you to what conclusions, you know, in terms of things that were predictive of obesity?
So we used transfer learning and convolutional neural networks to process the images. And one of the reasons why we did the study is that there are actually quite a few studies showing that what you have access to, so the built environment influences health and influences obesity prevalence in the US. But studies tend to measure different things. So some would measure the amount of green spaces, some would look at sidewalks, some would look at other aspects of the neighborhood. And we wanted to see if there was a way that we could process images and build something that was comprehensive. So instead of trying to count one thing, can we count everything that is present and then use that as a way to look at health in neighborhoods?
Okay, yeah, I think that's what I was getting at with the question. You can, you know, if you think about this in terms of counting, you know, maybe, you know, the number of hospitals or grocery stores or green spaces or parks or, you know, running tracks or things like that. Yeah. And your approach was to, well, you know, that's kind of your traditional feature engineering. Let's just throw all these at a network and give it some labels and see if it can predict anything. Yeah. And did it work?
It worked. The review process was very funny. I don't know if it's funny, but it was interesting.
How so?
Comments like, this is too predictive. And
meaning they didn't think that it was actually working?
They had never seen anything like it before. And so we were arguing that maybe the reason why you haven't seen
this is in public health journals as opposed to machine learning journals.
Precisely.
Okay.
And when I did run the models, I thought it was too predictive too. And okay. We had to rerun it multiple times. And then we tried several different approaches because I wanted to be as careful as I could be.
Yeah.
Send it out for review. And that was one of the comments that the reviewers wrote back. And so we had to explain that if you look at the literature, people have always looked at a single thing and we're trying to look at everything together at the same time. So if we're getting predictions that have not been observed in the past, we don't really have anything to compare to. So we can say this person did something similar. So let's look at the differences.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so did you try applying any explainability techniques or model introspection techniques to try to get a sense for what the model was keying in on to make its prediction?
We started working on that. Never finished. But... but what we found is green spaces seem to be a very strong predictor.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting. And then another topic that you talked a little bit about was product surveillance. What does that mean?
So the specific example I gave was on unsafe food products. So unsafe. Okay. When people consume unsafe food products, they can get sick, they can even die from it. And so we've been thinking about ways in which we could monitor unsafe food products to identify them as soon as possible. So then someone like the FDA can do a food recall.
Okay.
So they do a food recall, they would pull out everything from the market for that particular batch. And then hopefully people do not continue to consume it and get sick from it. So this particular study looked at Amazon product reviews, where we collected data over, well, someone else collected data and then made it publicly available over several years. And then we looked at our data to see whether we could build, what did we use for this? We used BERT. So if we could train BERT to identify unsafe food products based on the reviews that people were writing.
And what were some of the indicators that, or examples of the indicators that a product was unsafe? Was it as simple as I ate this whatever and I was vomiting in 2 days or something?
Yeah. So people will use very specific descriptions, like it had an odor, the taste had changed, and then they'll talk about symptoms like vomiting. But then you also had products that were mislabeled. So it wasn't that they were bad, is that they either contained something that was not included in the label. So people who have allergies were complaining about that. So someone would say, I have a milk allergy and this has milk, but it didn't say that it has milk.
Mm. And so the data set that you used, was this one of these kind of large Amazon product review data sets? It wasn't specific to your case at all?
Yeah, it was one of those data sets. And then we had to process the data. So we started the project in the summer of 2017. And it was supposed to be a summer project. So one of these data science for social good programs at University of Washington.
Okay.
And at the end of the summer, we were still processing the data because we're trying to figure out, the data was huge, but then also trying to figure out whether it could be useful at all was a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the major challenge for the project was actually processing the data, because we have Amazon data, we have the product information, and then we had information from the FDA about products that they had recalled. So we had to take the Amazon data and match it to the FDA data. And that's where the issue started. Mm. Because
the FDA data didn't have an ASIN.
Nope. It didn't.
That would have made it a lot easier.
It would have been so much easier. And it would have even been more easier if they actually had the complete product code ID, which they didn't. So You would have products that were recalled and some of the numbers had been stripped and you have an incomplete code, and we would not know whether it actually matched the Amazon data, the product that we're looking at, or if it was a different product. So we spent so much time trying to match those numbers to each other.
I don't know whether this is something that impacted your results, but I would think on top of that, particularly, I think it's come to light a lot now in the context of COVID, but there's a ton of manipulation of listings on the part of sellers, particularly these folks that will import products from China. A lot of times they're, they'll create these, fake listings for things that Amazon is not paying attention to, get a lot of generic reviews, and then swap it out for respirators or, masks or things like that, that, Amazon is paying more attention to, so that they have a review base. There's a ton of games that folks play with these that I've got to imagine that if you're trying to do something for real with this kind of data will make for a lot of messy work.
Yeah, definitely. The data that we had was a bit older, so I don't know how much people were paying attention to Amazon at the time. Okay. But things have definitely changed, and that would have affected our results.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other key themes from your talk that we haven't touched on?
Was there anything else? I'm trying to remember. So I talked a bit about social media data, but that's also linked to health behaviors, because we've been looking at how people talk about things like exercise and diet and social media, specifically Twitter, and how that could inform us about prevalence of physical activity in the US, for example. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. What's your sense for the state of the application of machine learning in the field? Just looking at or thinking about the various places that you've applied it, it seems like there's a ton of opportunity to take off the shelf models and things that you're not kind of making exotic new network architectures. You're just kind of applying stuff to data sets in interesting ways, sometimes, for interesting places, and you're able to make a contribution. Is that do you think that will continue for a while? Like, what's the dynamic in that field for folks interested in machine learning and and health?
I think in my experience, the simple methods tend to work pretty well, and I don't need to go to the complicated stuff or try to create anything. And it's, for me, I always aim to start with the simple stuff. So If I have a data set, what is the simplest method I can use for this? And then if that doesn't work, then I start thinking of more complicated approaches. And I think there are so many opportunities for doing that. There's so many different data sources that we can use to answer different questions, and then move from not just answering questions, we're thinking about how do we create real-time applications that can impact people's lives. The foodborne one is a very good example because we're able to work with the Department of Health and they could use that information for decision-making. But you can think about all the ways in which we can get data, process data using the simple approaches, and then have someone use that for making decisions that can improve people's health.
Mm-hmm. What are some examples of, do you have ideas that, you know, come to mind that are things that are still needed in that community? I guess, you know, where I'm coming from is, you know, we talk about a lot of exotic stuff on the podcast all the time, you know, these gigantic models and kind of cutting edge approaches there. And we talk about, even in the context of public health, you know, very, you know, tech forward approaches to things like contact tracing, mm-hmm. you know, but it's just striking me that you're having, you know, a huge impact with stuff that we consider pedestrian in some circles, right? It's like CNN on some satellite images. I did that in a Kaggle competition. You mean I could actually impact people's lives with this?
Yeah. I think it always starts at the community level. So thinking about what is happening in local communities and how impact can be had in that. So one organization that I'm involved with is Data Science Africa. Okay. And we have conferences across the continents, but usually in West Africa or East Africa. We actually have one ongoing right now, but it's all virtual because no one can meet.
Yeah.
But people will come to those spaces are working in their local communities, and they're using some of those very simple approaches to solve problems around agriculture, around health, develop tools around health education, for example. How can we make sure that young people get access to information that they need? If it's a topic that's either sensitive in their culture and something that they don't usually talk about, but they need that information, how can we get that information to them on their mobile phones, which they have? So very simple approaches, and also making a point of engaging with the community. Mm-hmm. So instead of just thinking, what is the problem that this community might be dealing with and then trying to solve it, actually go into the community and ask people, what is the problem you're dealing with? So if you have a local farm, what is the problem you have on your farm and how can I help you solve that problem?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Yeah. Cool. Well, Elaine, thanks so much for taking the time to chat. It was great learning about your research.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Sam.
All right, everyone, that's our show for today. To learn more about today's guest or the topics mentioned in this interview, visit twimmelai.com. Of course, if you like what you hear on the podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review the show on your favorite podcatcher. Thanks so much for listening, and catch you next time.